I'm Christopher Ludden. This is The Connection. Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, shared a dangerous and vaguely scandalous problem with any number of rich old institutions in downtown America, like the University of Chicago, or Yale, or Penn, and many more famous schools. It had a grand endowment and worldwide connections, but across the street from the campus it faced a rotting neighborhood that menaced its students and its future. Enter, in the Trinity case, a new president, Evan Dobell, in 1994, with what has become a model and a challenge to colleges and communities all over the country. The plan was not so gradually to bring Trinity's mostly poor Latino neighbors in on the promise of education and opportunity. It was also to introduce every Trinity student to the world next door with some confidence and compassion. In short, the plan was to knock the town gown wall down and keep it down. Evan Dobell, who's our guest this hour, had done a little bit of everything in politics and education before Trinity. He had been the mayor of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and he'd been Jimmy Carter's chief of protocol. He'd run the city college system in San Francisco. It was all a sort of preparation for something new in college and city renewal in Hartford. Connection listeners, how does a moat become a bridge? And how, in fact, do universities compare with stadiums, say, or art museums, or tax-free industry as means of recharging American cities? What is the model for rebuilding St. Louis, or Baltimore, or Indianapolis? The connection phone is 1-800-423-8255. Evan Dobell, the president of Trinity College, is our guest. I want to just start with your idea of a comparison. The New England Patriots almost moved their franchise from outside Boston to Hartford, and the state of Connecticut went into contortions to give away the store, basically, for something that might recharge the capital. They decided against it in the end. How does an NFL franchise and a rebuilt stadium downtown compare with the promise of a city college, for example?
You know, Chris, I think it has a lot to do with perception versus reality. It seems to me that around America today, cities get validated by professional athletic franchises, much like perhaps orchestras or museums validated
there
cities.
There are cathedral towns now.
It's amazing to see it happen and to have your name listed in these sports pages. I thought it would be a great thing for Hartford to have the Patriots, but it would be perception more than reality. The reality is there home ownership? The reality is there a good school system? Is there a good transportation system? Are jobs available? Is it affordable? Is it accessible? Those are the kinds of things that make cities, to have neighborhoods that are strong, not just simply a downtown, but true community. And building community is about the hardest thing to do in America, and it takes more than a sports franchise to do it.
What did Trinity College do for Hartford? Let's tell that story, if you would.
Well, I hope what it's done is give Hartford confidence. Hartford, to me, is one of the great underrated cities in America. It's an old city of a great history and tradition. It's a city that
Mark Twain City, Stevens City.
Absolutely, the end of the 19th century, the home of Fuller Brush, Colt Firearms, one of the most powerful cities in America. But it went through cyclical complications and problems. It's a city that historically, by the laws of Connecticut, was not allowed to annex property, and therefore it was restricted in its growth physically. And you had a core city in many other communities, which became the entire city in Hartford when the demographics changed. And you have a community that is undereducated and underemployed, and one that needs to be lifted. And what we've tried to do at Trinity is not only do something for our community and our neighborhood and our school, but also to give confidence once again to Hartford that you can get things done. And I'd like to think that that's the major effect of our enterprise in the south end of Hartford.
Some cities and some schools have done it spectacularly. None more, it seems to me, than MIT in Greater Boston over the last 50 years, Harvard too. Some cities have been spectacularly unsuccessful. New Haven's gotten poorer and poorer in modern times as Yale has gotten richer and richer. What makes the difference?
Well, you have to have a will to do it. And you have to be willing to invoke moral authority and back it up with your own money. The University of Southern California in Los Angeles, to me, has always been the premier institution of connecting. That city's public institution is really its private university in USC, not UCLA. It just strikes me that what you need to do is you can't just talk and you can't make studies that you put on shelves. You have to put up your own money from your own endowment, and you can't say that you have all this money and you need it for a rainy day. The reality is we have in colleges and universities, foundations, over $200 billion, more than all the foundations put together. We're tax-free. We're tax-exempt. We make millions of dollars a year tax-exempt. We need to put some of that money back into these communities that support us. And to simply say that we're the academy and that we have no connection and it's philanthropy's responsibility or government's responsibility to me is irresponsible.
I want to hear more about sort of putting your money where your intentions are, but I also want to suggest, I mean, it can't be the only thing. I mean, the reason MIT is so important in New England is that it's seeded companies, thousands of them by now, hundreds every year, of smart young engineers who are alert to the new economy.
Absolutely.
And who generate their own money. This isn't, and MIT isn't spreading its endowment around.
Well, it's a great research university, and MIT and Stanford invest their resources in some of these companies, and one of their complications for some of these schools is they have a hard time keeping people in master's programs because they can see they can make so much money in the technologies. But for us, our investment was singularly based on children. I'm not wise enough to be able to determine what to do with complicated individuals at 20 years old, but I know what I can do about a 3 or 4 year old child. I know every study talks about self-esteem and confidence and critical thinking is all over by the time children are 4 or 5 years of age. We have a system of America, not of education, but of remediation. We have child care, which has given no priority concerning up against the graduate programs for PhDs. We need to spend the money and the effort at youngsters. That's what we're doing at Trinity. It's a learning corridor that starts at zero and takes people up from there. It's a Boys and Girls Club for after-school activities, the first in the country on a college campus, a Montessori-style public elementary school, a public middle school, a science, math, and technology resource high school, the Hartford Academy of Performing Arts. It's all based on something no one can argue about. There is no difference on it. It's for kids and giving kids opportunities that they have never had before and the ability to dream again, because these are 10-year-old kids who have no dreams.
But you're confusing me. It seems to me you're blurring a line here. I mean, are you the school superintendent in Hartford or in your neighborhood, or are you running a little Ivy?
Well, you have to remember now in Hartford that the school system was taken over by the state government, by a board of trustees, which lost confidence in the schools. And we have now a school superintendent, Tony Amato from New York, who we have great confidence in. But when I started this program, we needed to be both. We needed to be both an institution of higher education and also a catalyst for the public schools, and that's what we did. But I don't want to run the schools. That's not what we do at Trinity.
Talk about, I mean, define this, give us the dimensions of this learning corridor. Who's on it and what's happening? And how does a young Latino family get involved here?
The learning corridor has several aspects. It has the Aetna Corporation gave money along with the state for a center for family and children. It's very important for us to deal with children and also important for us to deal with kids who have kids. We have the elementary school, the middle school, the resource high school, which is a merit high school for science and math and performing arts. We have all the common space for community groups to come together. We have Trinity on one side. We have three major hospitals on the other side. We are trying to provide housing where we're building 80 houses right now for $80,000 for families with gross incomes of $46,000 or less. The critical part of the Trinity Hartford plan is that we are not gentrifying the neighborhood. We're not doing what they did in the West End of Boston years ago or other cities across the country. What we were saying, and I'm not giving money to our faculty or administrators as bonuses to move into the neighborhood to displace a Latino family. What we're trying to say is everybody in America deserves the opportunity to have an education, to have a job, and to have home ownership and to have equity in that home. We only had 11% home ownership in our neighborhood. That has to change. Otherwise, cities continually are going to be marginalized and are continually not going to have hope and continually going to have to be bailed out by the suburbs. And I think that just in many ways polarizes America.
Evan Dobell is our guest. He's the president of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Before that, he had a variety of political missions, including running the City College system in San Francisco, the Middlesex Community College outside Boston. He was Jimmy Carter's chief of protocol, an important fundraiser for the Mondale ticket. He's done a little bit of everything in urban and national politics, and he's put it all together in the service of a solution to a practically national problem of rich old institutions of the educational variety in dilapidated American cities that were declining all around them. What's to do? At the kernel of this thing, it seems to me, Evan Dobell, is the question of why MIT makes New England richer and why Yale seems to have made New Haven poorer. It involves not just opening the endowment, but it involves a kind of relationship with the neighborhood where graduates can see their talent in real communities and not simply fly off to wherever they came from. 1-800-423-8255. Evan Dobell in Hartford, Connecticut has become famous for knocking the walls down, getting to know the neighbors in a new way. I think it's fascinating that, as you say, you're not simply trying to pretty up the neighborhood and get faculty to live next door. Let's put this to the test.
And it's working too, Chris. I mean, what we're doing is we're tapping in. This generation in America today is much like my generation in the early 60s. It's a generation that really values community service and wants the institutions that they belong to or work with to share their values. And one of the interesting looks that we have at how we're doing as an institution is to see what our applications are. When I came 4.5 years ago, Trinity's applications were 2,900 applications for 500 positions in the freshman class. This year, we're going to go over 5,000. And they're coming from all over the country because these kids are not looking at the perception of institutions as their families did at one time. They're looking for institutions that share their values. And that tells me something about this generation. It tells me something that Trinity's doing the right thing.
How do they get the message?
They get the message.
They get the message
through the profile. The message is that we are a city, we are a college, a liberal arts college in a city, or a college where you have the opportunity to study everything. It's not a vocational or a career kind of education. It's one-on-one with faculty. You have a guaranteed academic internship. The community service is available and expected of undergraduates. 14 of the 1,800 undergraduates at Trinity are involved in community service. And we now have the Megacities program, which is 24 cities around the world. It's very important for us to tie into the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, to tie into the nunneries in Kathmandu, to tie into various organizations in Santiago or in San Juan or in Cape Town. We are not doing students any favor by not teaching them how to work effortlessly and with grace with people of different cultures. But the complication that American universities always had is the youngsters, when they went overseas, they would go to the, you know, London and Paris and Rome, and they would become more comfortable with people in the European continent than the people who lived across the street. And race is still the major division in our country. It will be in my lifetime and continue to be. And we have to do something to get people to understand each other and to celebrate difference. And we do it at Trinity by making sure the community service is a seamless component of our education.
I'm glad you mentioned Bilbao, simply because we've done a couple of programs with the Bilbao Museum and with Frank Gehry, who designed it. It's become famous not only as maybe one of the great buildings of the 20th century, but also as an alternative model, especially to the sort of the stadium notion of urban development, a cultural institution that sees the world's attention, and also it elicited from a connection listener the news that apparently the mayor's office in Boston knows well that between the symphony, the museums, the cultural institutions together draw more people into the city, more tourist and sort of visitor dollars than the Major League Hockey, basketball, baseball, and football franchises all put together.
You had 1.7 million people visit Bilbao last year to go to the Guggenheim Museum. 1.7 million visitors who, I would argue, 90% never heard of Bilbao, Spain before the Guggenheim was built, even though it's a city of 500,000 people in a strong industrial part of the Basque region. But that's tells you that people can be drawn to it. On the other hand, you have museums like the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, which is built up over a highway, inaccessible, when it could have been built in downtown Los Angeles and fundamentally changed 50 square blocks of that city. Isn't that regrettable that Bilbao showed how to use intellectual property as a tool of economic development while others isolate themselves continually, even now in the turn of the millennium?
What do your fellow college presidents, just in Connecticut, the president of Yale, for example, Richard Levin, or of Connecticut College for Women in New London, say about the Trinity model?
Well, Rick Levin, I just quoted at a conference and wrote him a letter and told him I hoped it was okay. And he wrote me a letter back kindly saying how...
What was okay?
That was okay that I quote him. What I was quoting him about was on affirmative action. And I said that he said this isn't about affirmative action. When you talk about African-Americans being hired, it's a matter of justice. And he wrote me a note saying that he looked to what Trinity did in Hartford as a way of having justice in America. Claire Gaudiani at Khan College has come and visited us, as have Roger Hull at Union and other institutions around the country, as they try to determine what they can do for their communities. And we're happy that in some way we can be helpful to others.
1-800-423-8255. Evan Dobell, the president of Trinity College, is our guest. He's becoming famous as the author of a new model of town and gown harmony in Hartford, Connecticut. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Trinity connection. Carol is calling from a car phone.
Hi, this is Carol Nathan. I live in the town of Foxborough. And first of all, I want to compliment the college on the fact that they really do walk the walk and, walk what they're talking about. And that a friend of mine is a freshman there, and she celebrates Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and was invited to a tea as a freshman, a tea that I believe the president had for the students celebrating this. And we were all quite impressed. It really was an outreach to these Jewish students. The other comment I wanted to make is about the stadium. Having lived in Foxborough for almost 20 years, I can assure you, stadiums do bring no economic benefits, true benefits. And I also happen to be one of the ones that's getting, negatively impacted by the new Foxborough Stadium that's being built. So I'm sad that they didn't go to Hartford, but I'm glad for Hartford that they did not.
Maybe you should go to Hartford, Carol.
Well, it sounds really exciting with what they're doing at Trinity College with the schooling that they're offering for high schoolers.
Well, Hartford didn't win the Patriots. You're stuck with them, Carol, there in Foxborough.
Not happy about it at all.
Carol, thank you for the call. Evan Dobell, do you want to comment?
Only in the sense that stadiums have an importance in life. They certainly had it in the hippodromes and everything else in the old world. But the reality is they were not the end-all and be-all. And I'm always fearful when I go around the country and I see cities define themselves on whether they have a sports franchise. It's sad. It does not make a city. It just makes a perception on ESPN, and that's what it is. But it doesn't change the life, I think, of the everyday life and opportunity of youngsters. And I don't know how we're going to sustain a vibrant democracy on sports teams. We need to have real education, real jobs, and real opportunity.
Maybe you ought to put universities on ESPN.
I one time proposed that we have an educational channel that would have a real-time broadcast from all over the world of lectures and speeches that go on at colleges, but we weren't able to get a corporate sponsor for it.
Our anthropologist is better than your anthropologist. 1-800-423-8255, the Trinity College and Hartford connection. John is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Hi, I'd like to hear Evan speak about what Johns Hopkins has done down in Baltimore, because I think they started a long time ago, probably back in the 60s and 70s, to approach this problem and recognize each city's makeup is different. Hopkins has a couple of different campuses spread throughout Baltimore, but they're always in controversial and mixed neighborhoods. And so that's allowed them to do some things and not allowed them to do others. But I think what's interesting is that what I'm hearing from Bilbao versus the stadium is that the function of the institution is really the key to this. Hopkins Hospital is in the middle of the poorest section of Baltimore. its function is pretty clearly defined to reach out to the neighborhoods as well as to provide world-class help. So it's both reaching out as well as reaching in a more immediate sense to the people around them and respecting what these neighborhoods are. And I imagine, having been in Washington, that you're somewhat familiar with what the school did, and I'm wondering how you would comment on that versus Trinity, which is maybe a more simple yet more difficult dynamic.
It's interesting. I've always been a great admirer of the Baltimore revitalization under former Mayor Schaefer, particularly around the waterfront and the Science Museum and the National Aquarium and all the things that they've accomplished in Federal Hill, which I think is a brilliant housing project. I think Johns Hopkins, over the years, from Milton Eisenhower to Bill Richardson, have made every opportunity around their medical school to try to connect. I still think they could do a great deal more, particularly along North Charles Street, as you go from the train station up to Johns Hopkins itself. It's a liberal arts college like we are in the undergraduate program, but basically it's steered by their huge medical enterprise, especially out on the campus as it connects to the Veterans Administration Medical Hospital. But they have made efforts, but they too have a long way to go, and they have great challenges because, as you suggested, they have multiple campuses. But for their liberal arts undergraduates, it would be great if there could be a whole new revitalization along the park, along the art museum, all the way to the railroad station.
John, interesting question. Can I just bend that just a little bit? Baltimore is run in a way by Johns Hopkins people. I mean, there's a Hopkins establishment, as there's a Harvard establishment here, or a UT establishment in Austin, Texas. I suspect there's not a Trinity College establishment in Hartford, and there may never be one. How important is it, in your view, of Trinity's role to get graduates to stay in the neighborhood?
It would be great for them to stay. Hartford still has great corporations, insurance corporations, Aetna, Travelers, the Hartford, Cigna, has United Technologies, which is Pratt Whitney and Otis Elevator and Sikorsky Aircraft. There's a lot of opportunities for employment in Hartford. The complication that you suggest is there probably still is an establishment in Baltimore and some other cities, corporate establishment. But for many of us in Hartford, the takeovers and mergers of the last number of years has meant that the individual in charge of these companies don't go to bed anymore in Hartford. They go to bed in Boston. They go to bed in Philadelphia. That means that vertically they're not as aligned with the nonprofit organizations, the symphonies, the stage, the colleges as they once were. So the challenge really is for the nonprofit institutions, the Wadsworth Athenaeum, which was founded by J.P. Morgan, the Mark Twain House for Trinity, to step up and provide the leadership that used to be provided by the corporate heads.
Interesting. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Trinity College in Hartford connection. Kathleen is on the line.
Hi, Chris. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Evan, how are you?
Of his or of mine?
Of yours, definitely, and also of Evan's.
I'm a fan of yours, Kathleen. Go ahead.
I was hoping, Evan, that you could talk about the beginning of the story of Trinity's involvement with the community, because I happen to know that Trinity's neighborhoods are fairly well organized, and there was actually groups for you to engage with. And I know that that's a very different situation than Yale has, where their communities are in real disarray, and they don't really have an opportunity to engage with an organized group.
Well, we've been very fortunate that the CBOs, the community-based organizations in Hartford, HART particularly, H-A-R-T, Hartford Area Rally Together, have been long, strong CBOs. We're also been a member of what we call SINA, which is an acronym for our southeast part of the city, that has been composed of the hospitals and Trinity for over 20 years now. So we have had the opportunity to have conversation and for people to have trust, if you will, in institutions maybe doing the right thing. We just never did it. Our expectations were always kept low in the community. To me, the only way you can get things done in communities and neighborhoods, maybe in life, is to take risk. And you have to be vulnerable to risk. And I tried to raise the expectations to such a degree that we couldn't fail at Trinity, and the hospitals couldn't fail. Not only couldn't we have failed because we'd lose an enormous amount of money, but we'd lose reputation. You have to throw sometimes your hat over the wall and then go over the wall after it. Otherwise, you can always raise expectations a little bit and then surpass them, but you still haven't really accomplished anything.
Jeffy?
But you are correct about the neighborhood organizations.
Do you want to follow up?
Yeah, actually, my question is more about the fact that when a university goes to a community and tries to engage that community, I think it's really important for the community to have a voice and to tell the university what they really want from the what they want from the university, and for the university to listen to it and not to turn around and say, we're a university, we'll give you access to our courses because that's what we do. That's what we do as a university. And when in fact the community might say, no, what we really want is access to your auditorium to hold our events. And what we really want is access to some of your professors to do some research projects for us.
Well, you're right. And that's exactly the model that we built on, which is why I suspect we're successful. We have the Trinity Center for Neighborhoods, which was begun by a significant grant by then Secretary of HUD, Henry Cisneros. That was added to by the Cerdna Foundation, the Ublein Foundation. The neighborhood ostensibly told Trinity what we needed, and then we produced it. And it was schools, it was housing. It's nothing complicated. You know, people make too big a deal about urban renewal. You don't need any more x-rays. You don't need any more urine samples. You don't need any more blood tests. You know what to do. Build schools, build housing, and give you opportunity.
Let's take a short break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by the construction site Blocks and Building Toys for Girls and Boys Aged Infant to Infinity. Toys with connections that snap, stack, screw, and slide together at constructiontoys.com. And by CSC Consulting, helping clients achieve business results through innovative consulting and systems integration solutions. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Evan Dobell is our guest. He's the president of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and he's become the sort of one-man embodiment of a new idea in relations between rich old institutions in poor, oftentimes Latino neighborhoods of urban America. What's to be done? He knocked the walls all down. He's still knocking them down. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. But 1-800-423-TALK. What more do we need to know about a different model for cities and downtown institutions? You made a very interesting point before the break that in city after city, the universities and colleges, professional schools, new colleges are, in a way, the last great stakeholders after the manufacturers have gone, after the banks have been bought by international institutions. The establishment is the colleges. It's very much so in Boston, and I'm not talking about Harvard and MIT, but Boston University, Emerson College, Suffolk University downtown, Northeastern. This is the new power group. Are they ready to step up to the roles that bankers and corporate titans used to play?
I think that's the transition you're seeing in American higher education, which has always been an insular world. I have four academic degrees, but my perceived strength is that I've had other kinds of lives in business or in politics. And that seems to be a new model that people are looking at. The reality is when you take a look at a place like Providence, Rhode Island, which has been extraordinary, you see it came back because of Providence College, Brown, RISD, but probably most importantly, Johnson & Wales. You take a look
What's
at
Johnson
Philadelphia.
Wales?
Johnson & Wales is a great 2-year school that that teaches mostly hospitality cooking. Has locations around the country. But you take a look, Chris, at Philadelphia. Here you have one of the, I think, probably the fourth largest city in the United States. Eddie Rendell is considered by almost everyone to be at least one of the top two or three mayors in this past decade in the United States. And when I talked to him several months ago, he was he was telling me how the complications were they didn't have one major corporation that's headquartered in Philadelphia anymore, and one major bank. And he himself...
Where did they go? What are we talking about?
They went to Pittsburgh. They
Scott
were bought.
Paper. I
exactly.
Mean,
they're gone. And the reality is, he said when the Symphony Orchestra needed to have a fundraiser for the extraordinary Philadelphia Symphony, he was the chairman. It wasn't a corporate person. It was the mayor of the city. A political figure being ostensibly the fundraising chairman of the event, having to make the phone calls to people to support it.
This was a Mellon Bank city. Where did
right.
Mellon Bank go?
I can't tell you that precisely. Perhaps it was more of a Pittsburgh-based bank than a Philadelphia-based bank. But who would know?
It's true in Boston, too. I mean, the biggest bank in town is owned by Rhode Islanders.
Well, who would think 20 years ago the Bank of America would be in Charlotte? From San Francisco.
But it leaves university and college presidents.
And hospitals.
Interesting.
Hospitals and colleges and universities are the last great stakeholders in cities. And they are going through the complications of either hiring people who have external abilities, or they're hiring by their presidents or by their board of trustees, vice presidents for communities, much like Harvard has done, much like Yale has done.
They're not necessarily the most popular people among the folks who vote in city elections. Are they up to the political job? Do they know what the political assignment is?
Well, that's the interesting question. I don't know if they know what the political assignment is, and I think they're up to it if they could have it defined for them. But at times, you can spend it's about vision. It's about humanity. It's about common sense. If you look around your neighborhood and it's not working, do something about it. I didn't start in Hartford trying to solve the problems of Hartford or Connecticut. I looked around like I did in San Francisco or I did in Lowell, Mass. When I worked with the late Senator Paul Tsongas. It was the same situation. What can we do in our immediate neighborhood? So I took the Middlesex Community College, which is in Bedford, Massachusetts, a suburb, bought the old Wang building in downtown Lowell, and hopefully was part of turning around that city by having thousands of students in the downtown area providing resources for retail stores. In San Francisco, we had 7 campuses and 152 learning sites throughout that city, in every neighborhood of the community. And in Hartford, we're doing what we can in our neighborhood. If everyone in the country, in cities, would simply take their own sphere of influence in their own neighborhood and do something, it would be a lot better than sitting on all these millennium committees or these 2001 committees and start having Tuesday committees. What are we doing Tuesday? What are we doing next week? Don't sit and plan it. You know, we have all the plans we need. We need to have people take action and do something.
You got a lot of press coverage for knocking down crack houses. What did you do about crime in general?
Well, the reality is that we probably moved it somewhere else. I don't think we solved the problems of drugs or the related vices that go with it, prostitution or gambling, that are illegal. When I came to Trinity several years ago, it was a pretty tough neighborhood. The U.S. attorney, who's now a federal judge, Chris Droney, put in the RICO laws pretty strongly and took a lot of people right off the streets. And it created, if you will, an opportunity for me. It was a DMZ, if you will, that allowed me a window of opportunity that we went through very quickly. And I had suggested to our board, and our board was very generous in providing $600,000 to buy these crack houses and knock them down, because I needed to show the community that we were serious. This wasn't going to be another conversation. We were going to do something. And when they saw that, those individuals who for many years had heard all the rhetoric and no action taken, they had their expectations raised, and they were willing to come in and talk to me.
Crime is one thing. Education is a bigger challenge, it seems to me. What do you do, and what do you recommend for the problem that I think Boston exemplifies brilliantly? I mean, here it is, maybe the world capital of higher education.
No question.
And a city in which ambitious parents feel they have to basically move out of town or at a minimum try parochial schools to give their kids a middle-class opportunity. So you have an enormous contrast between, I mean, the world comes to Boston to get smart, and smart people have to leave Boston to get a primary education?
Well, you know, it always saddens me. I always dislike those who take off after schools and school teachers in the systems. You know, if you take a look at the real numbers, and if a youngster starts school at the age of six and goes every year to school and never misses a day, never sick one day, never taken out by their parents for one day, by the time they graduate from high school, they will have spent 9% of their life in school. Not five, the first 5 years, no weekends, not 18 hours a day, no summers. So if 91% of the time is spent in the community, in the neighborhood, to say the schools are the ones who are responsible for turning this around is nonsense. We have to be determined to turn around community. And I've seen a lot of words coming out of Washington, a lot of words coming out of state capitals, but I don't see anybody taking action to turn cities around. You know, the war on poverty in the 1960s lasted for about 18 months. It was a skirmish. There was no war on poverty. We have to lift people up and give them hope, and we have to spend money. People who suggest that it's not only money are right, but it's a lot of it is resources and reallocation of resources into these urban areas. And the schools need to be fully funded. The faculty need to have professional development and need to have pay scales that are appropriate. And it needs to be attractive for a young person to go teach. And this is the generation that can do it. This generation, much like the early 60s, and who wanted to go in the Peace Corps, want to do something in their cities. You'll see kids and juniors and seniors in high schools who are doing community service that we never even thought about 20 or 30 years ago. And I think there could be leadership to motivate youngsters to help turn around these school systems. And mostly to turn around kids who don't believe school will lead to a diploma that will lead to anything in their life. I remember David Reisman, who was a mentor of mine, if you will, the great emeritus professor at Harvard, told me that they did a study in the Roxbury section of Boston where youngsters actually thought that the best way to get out of the ghetto, if you will, was to win the lottery. Now, how's that for a comment on hope in America, that the only way to get out and to be successful is maybe hit the lottery? That, to me, is an extraordinary admission of failure in our American cities.
What do the listeners think? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Trinity College and Hartford connection with Evan Dobell, the president of Trinity College. Dave is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Dave.
Hi. Everything I'm hearing is just so wonderful. Trinity just sounds like a great place. I've lived in New Haven. I've lived in Bridgeport. I've lived in Worcester. I've lived in Philadelphia, I've lived in Alston, and now I'm living in Natick. So I've kind of seen the rub between academia and neighborhoods in those cities. I guess my question is, how do you take a huge upper middle class student population that transitions every 4 years and create a stable community, or at least a sensitive community, right next to neighborhoods that are established and have been there for, you know, many, many, many years?
David, that's a good question, and it's a challenging question. A lot of it has to do with your profile that you present to students and the kinds of students who apply to you. We're up probably 70-75% in early admissions. I would think that we probably have double the number of students at Trinity now who have Trinity as their first choice. And it's because of their understanding of where Trinity is and what we're trying to accomplish. That's how we can do a stable situation. A lot of colleges, it's more complicated. I've run institutions, community colleges, that are open admissions, and therefore everyone comes, and they come for different reasons. They really go for many ways from school to work kinds of educations. I would say it has to be the mission of the institution, and it has to have a tone set at the very top of what's important. And if that's not consistent and sustained, then it won't happen. And this can't be my program at Trinity. It has to be owned by the faculty and the trustees and the alumni, and it is.
Dave, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Trinity College Hartford connection. Charles is on the line.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to applaud President Dobell. We've admired his leadership for quite some time.
Who's we?
Well, I direct something that's based at Harvard called the National Committee on Partnerships for Children's Health. It's funded by the Centers for Disease Control. And I'd like to, it's co-chaired by Julius Richmond, the former Surgeon General, and Jeanetta Cole, the former president emeritus of Spelman.
Yes.
I'd just like to suggest a somewhat different frame and scale from the one you've been talking about. We have about 4,000 post-secondary institutions in the country, including 2,000 community colleges, each with different strengths and different kinds of things, roles that they can play in the community. And with this kind of unsurpassed knowledge industry, which is clearly, you know, kind of far and away the best in the world, and the unprecedented knowledge base that we have, we don't actually seem to be getting the kind of results for kids in particular that we would expect or want. And I think part of the issue is that virtually every college and university in the country has a long list that they point to with pride of projects in the community. But the complex problems of kids, how do we get better early childhood education? How do we get better schools? How do we get better, you know, health care for kids? How do we prevent a lot of the preventable behaviors that kids get into? Those complex problems can't be solved by uncoordinated, sporadic projects in the community. And I think we've learned that kind of while working in the immediate neighborhood at the grassroots level is crucial, it's not the exclusive answer by a long shot. And a lot of these issues have to be addressed by multiple colleges and universities working together under the leadership of the state and city systems that are responsible for getting results for kids. So there's a way in which I think that the focus on what individual institutions can do independently in their immediate neighborhoods is a lot less than what we can expect of higher education. And one recent development or emerging development, for example, in Florida, is that the state university system is being asked to work in a concerted way on improving school readiness programs statewide. I don't hear enough in the discussion. I'd like to hear more in the discussion, actually, about how higher education as a national industry can work with state government. Because the gaps between higher education and the immediate community can be explained in a lot of ways, but the gap between higher education and state government is more mystifying and really kind of stands in our way of addressing complex problems at scale.
I think you're right, Charles. It's a matter of will, and it's a matter of giving up territory, if you will, and pride, and being able to sit down at the table and realize that every college and university has equally important missions, whether it be a community college in Florida or the University of Texas or Stanford. And we all have to sit at a common table. But just like my institution needs leadership and states need leadership, we need leadership in the country. We need leadership from the Secretary of Education. We need leadership from the President to be able to work on this together. I realize that the Constitution doesn't mention education, and we've always maintained that education is singularly a local matter, and I don't debate that. But I do debate the fact, as you may, that it needs to be coordinated, that we need to raise expectations, and monies can be provided that would stimulate this. But we can learn a lot through consortium.
Is that what you mean by leadership, money?
It's certainly leadership. I mean, without money is like a policy without any substance. I mean, you have to be able to provide resources to make things happen. You can't just talk about it. That's what I see in presidential races. Everybody's talking, but when they say, "What are you going to do to reallocate the resources to make that happen?" Nobody wants to answer.
Okay, I'm glad you translated that, because it seems to me, I mean, what in the world does? You've got a lot more to tell the president. I don't mean to flatter you, than he to tell you, it would seem to me, about these issues. But this is the people's turn. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Allison is on a car phone.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure, Allison.
I work for City Year in Boston. It's a youth service organization. We have other sites across the country. We work very closely with AmeriCorps, which is a federal program to fund community service organizations, and I know that AmeriCorps works quite closely with colleges. Evan, I was wondering whether or not you had any experience with it, and whether that had in some way can answer your question about how state government and presidential vision and so on can help solve some of these problems.
I think AmeriCorps, I had worked with in California, I think its intentions are good, and I regret that two programs in particular, AmeriCorps and Head Start, are not fully funded. I've never understood it. I think the will is there among college students to participate hugely in an increased budget for AmeriCorps, and I think there are tens of thousands of kids who are not getting into Head Start programs because of lack of resources, and that makes absolutely no sense to me.
Hmm. Allison, good to hear from City Year. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Alex is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Alex. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. I actually just have a quick question for Dr. Dobell. I'm a senior at Boston College, and we do a lot of community service activities and whatnot. And I'm not very aware of the religious aspect or element of Trinity College. I do know that you have a rich Episcopalian tradition. I think that's correct. And I wonder what kind of religious elements go into the community service programs.
A rich Episcopalian tradition. Does that mean rich Episcopalians? Or?
Yes, correct.
Actually, Trinity was founded in 1823 as the first non-denominational college in Connecticut. It's had historic ties to the Episcopal Church, but it's never been a religious institution. We try to, I would think, define spirituality by not praying for change, but doing something about it. And I think we are trying not to subordinate scholarship to action. I think that's what we do, but we don't have any religious connotations to it, although we do have a new Center for Religion and Public Life that's headed by Mark Silk at the college, which talks about the issues of religion and how they affect public policy in every corner of the world.
Do you want to evangelize a little bit, Alex, or not?
No, I think that's fine. You answered my question correctly. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Alex. 1-800-423-8255. Peter is calling from Saranac Lake in New York.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Peter.
Great show. I just wanted to say that I remember Hartford from the late 70s and early 80s. I graduated from the college, and I've been very pleased with what Mr. DeBell has been able to do. And I guess one concern is, can this last? How do we keep this philosophy of social and spiritual responsibility going in cities, small towns, whatever? Can this cross the political waves that sweep the country, and can it go from there?
Well, you know, I hope so. You're in the state of New York, and I just spoke to Bob King the other day, who's a Trinity graduate who was just appointed by Governor Pataki to be chancellor of the SUNY system. And I was pleased to see in the Albany Times Union clip that I had gotten, and I called him, that he hoped to have the SUNY system emulate what we're trying to do at Trinity through their 64 campuses. It's those kinds of things, just like I am, you know, having my inspiration from, you know, Martin Luther King and others in life. If what we do at Trinity can stimulate others, then it goes on. But quite honestly, when people say to me, as they often do, what do I worry about? Hell, I worry about everything. You've got to sustain this thing. You've got to work all the time, and you've got to have a passion for this, just like you have to have a passion for anything in life. But I have a passion. You know, Monday we celebrate Dr. King's birthday. We still have not attained the ability to have equal opportunity for everyone, and that's all we're really trying to do at Trinity, is provide an even playing field.
Stick with the colleges and universities in the wrapping up here. They've always paid lip service to the communities, even as they tried to buy them up or turn their backs. How will we know a year, 5 years, 10 years down the road whether your model has been adopted?
It seems to me what you're going to find is that the criteria is going to change. One out of every four 18-year-olds or under lives in California. 46% are Latino. 28% are African-American. Very few. There's zero population growth among the traditional students who go to, if you will, private elite colleges. You're going to start to see the new America make choices at colleges and universities. And I believe that they're going to start making choices on institutions that share their values, not on the perceptions of what historically has been a good college. And I think all institutions are going to have to address the marketplace. And that marketplace, in my opinion, is going to change. And we only have to see an unrecognized death in the family, if you will, several weeks ago when Bradford College in Massachusetts died. It went out of business. It's only going to be the first of many that will start to go out of business because they're not going to be able to sustain themselves with traditional education.
Evan DeBell, this is enormously interesting. It's an important mission you've undertaken in Hartford, and I would love to hear more about it. But thank you for getting us started, and thanks to the callers and listeners who Trinity College alumni and others seem to know what you're up to and want to encourage you. Thank you enormously, Evan Dobell, president of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. By the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Magic Hour Communications, helping Fortune 1000 and fast-growing companies sell, market, and educate through videos, multimedia, websites, and presentations, magic-hour.com. And by PCs for Everyone, Windows 98, NT, and Linux-based computer systems and parts, building home PCs, corporate workstations, and servers, PCsForEveryone.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.